You know, we're live.
Okay.
Why don't you tell me something interesting?
You mean about this chapter?
This week on Physics FM, Jim and Randy talk about using compensation forces to defeat the uncertainty principle. Along the way, they discuss why you can measure the momentum but not the velocity, why you can't measure the electric field, what the energy-time-uncertainty relationship means, the internal time of a quantum system and how that differs from the regular time, and the Casimir effect. And of course, they talk about what happens when you mix too much alcohol and a length of rope at a physics party. All this when Jim and Randy explore Yakir Aharonov and Daniel Rorlick's Quantum Paradoxes, Chapter 8, Measurement and Compensation.
This was an informative chapter for me. I, you know, casually coming across different interesting quantum mechanical experiments going on in the science news. Mm-hmm. But I was completely unaware of this finding, which goes back to the 30s, that shows a really sneaky way to use measurement to sort of defeat one of the classically assumed limitations of quantum theory.
Well, yeah, this is actually really slick. So, I mean, I think we probably ought to talk about this.
Yeah, why have I not heard about this? I was delighted.
Well, I think, for one thing, is nobody ever talks about, at least in the undergraduate curriculum, they never talk about something like you can't measure the electric field with quantum mechanics. Or at least that's not something I've heard at that level. I have a book called, you know, Collective Electrodynamics. It's all about stuff like that.
Okay.
That makes an argument for the vector potential being this this very important thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's something that you may get in the formulation of quantum mechanics, but it's never really been explained very well, or it never came across very well in any of the classes. It's just something that you happen to do because the potentials are related to the energies, and the Hamiltonian's all about the energy. Right.
Right.
And the Hamiltonian is how we formulate quantum mechanics.
And is this a matter of, this is like a theoretical experimental question that since we can't measure, or at least we would assume that we can't measure an electric field to arbitrary accuracy, does that not come into play in the real world because we're talking about precision levels that are already beyond our ability to measure anyway?
I'm not really sure. I think the real issue here is everything we're going to talk about is, you know, when you can't measure the electric field instantaneously, basically.
Right.
Because it's not a, what did they call
canonical
it?
Observable?
Yes, because it's not a canonical observable in quantum mechanics. So that's just not something that we've really gotten into a lot in, say, an undergraduate curriculum. You're just asked by the professor, right, to
right.
find this. You don't spend a lot of time worrying about what is and what is not a canonical observable. You know that you're looking for the momentum, but the major issue for that has always been sort of mathematical, right? The momentum appears in the Hamiltonian, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the momentum is an easy thing to actually devise, or an easy thing to use in, you know, one of these integrals when you're trying to find the expectation value. Because it's because the momentum is a derivative of position in quantum mechanics. So because it's a derivative of position, you use that, and then you need the velocity divided by m.
But in quantum mechanics, I thought that momentum was a canonical observable.
It is.
Okay, so it's just a little counterintuitive to me, because in classical physics, you think you need to know the mass, you need to know the velocity. These are two separate quantities. But in quantum mechanics, the momentum is actually more fundamental than, I guess, either the energy or the position.
Well, I wouldn't say it's more fundamental than either the energy or the position. Why do you say the position?
Well, I thought the position, because there's an uncertainty in the position in this chapter that they're talking about, that you can't get to an arbitrary accuracy. Because, you know, when you measure position, doesn't that also entail?
Well, I mean, the momentum and the position are...
Some time.
The momentum and position are conjugate variables, right?
Right.
Each one is as the other one.
They're conjugate variables, but they're both canonical.
Yes. It's the velocity that's not canonical. The energy is perfectly fine. The magnetic field is perfectly fine, but the electric field is not.
Right.
And that has something to do with these being time derivatives.
Right.
Of a canonical variable. For example, the electric field is a time derivative of the vector potential. And like I was saying, that's something that this other book says is the most important thing ever, which is kind of weird because the vector potential is of limited use in classical physics because you can't measure it and it's kind of hard to create. And even if you create it, then you can change it around with the gauge transformation and all that other fun stuff. But in quantum mechanics, like I guess at this point we've been talking about for 3 or 4 episodes, it is this vector potential that moves electrons around. So what we want to do is we want to talk about what's going on with this velocity paradox first, I think, and then we can just remind everybody what happened with the velocity paradox, right?
Well, okay, let's start with the paradox.
Last time we had this velocity paradox, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what we were saying was that we could measure the momentum instantaneously, but we couldn't do the same thing with the velocity. We talked about that and we found some reasons why. And that was just because the velocity is not a canonical variable, but the momentum is.
Mm-hmm.
So we could measure that momentum instantaneously. We said the same 2 things about the magnetic field, which we could measure instantaneously, and the electric field, which we could not. But even though we went through that and there was a resolution to that paradox, it still doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I don't know about you, but I mean, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. There's something fishy about it somewhere. Can't really put my finger on it.
Okay. Because you'd figure that there should be a way to do this, even if the math seems to indicate otherwise, right?
What's the big deal, right? I mean, still, you look at this, you look at the math, maybe it tells you something, but what's the big deal about dividing by m? You know, what's the big deal about dividing by the mass?
To get your velocity, right.
That was the sort of problem that we sort of resolved by saying we couldn't measure this velocity, but we could measure this stranger quantity. I think we had the velocity.
It's non-observable.
Plus or minus some non-observable part, which was something strange to do with the detector, I think. Yeah, it had to do with the detector momentum. So the detector momentum snuck into our analysis.
Right. And that's the fun part of this chapter, is that can actually work for us, right?
Now that leads into our next discussion, this paradox for this chapter, which all came about because of Landau and some other people talking with Bohr, right?
Right.
And they're trying to measure this electric field with an electron going through some capacitor.
Right.
Like
Bohr is going crazy because he feels intuitively that you should be able to get this electrical field measurement out of the theory instantaneously with arbitrary precision, right? And he just can't figure out how. So I think that it was a couple of people working with him. So Gamow and...
Gamow was there. Landau was there.
And they presented him with a paper. Oh, yeah. And Rosenfield and Pirls.
Mm-hmm.
And they've presented a paper to him, which I guess argues why you can't measure the electric field strength, because you've got a radiating body whenever you've got an accelerated charge, right?
Yeah. So to measure the electric field, what happens is you send this electron perpendicular through an electric field, right?
Right.
And that electron's going to deflect in the electric field.
Right.
So the electric field's going to pull it towards one direction, and that'll deflect it from its straight line path.
This is how they originally measure the mass, right?
Yeah.
The charge to mass ratio. How much it curves in this field will tell you how much charge and how that relates to the mass. And so.
You can do that using the curvature. I think the way that we do it, the way I do it in the advanced lab, is we have this capacitor and we deflect the electron beam, and then we add a magnetic field to straighten it back out.
Okay.
And
right.
When you balance those 2 things, you can get a really good measurement of the E to M ratio.
Ah.
It's a little more difficult when you just deflect it. So you can get this electric field or this electron beam going in sort of a cyclotron motion, getting into a big circle.
Mm-hmm.
And you can change the power and stuff like that and measure the size of that circle.
Mm-hmm.
But now you have to measure the size of a circle of an electron beam inside of a vacuum tube and stuff like that. And I don't think that's really that accurate. It was really annoying when I tried to do it. We've got a demonstration like that. And the circle is a lot better demonstration. You know, this green glowing circle of an electron beam is a lot better demonstration than a straight line, right? but it's not quite as accurate. You don't get to play with quite as many fun toys.
That's a shame. That would be fun to have in the lab.
Hmm? What would be?
A cyclotron.
Yeah, it's just, it's not really a cyclotron. It's just a ring.
Oh.
Don't get to do your atom smashing with it.
Well, I wouldn't expect.
There was an old Scientific American article in the 1950s, How to Build Your Own Atom Smasher.
See, now that would be fun to have in the garage. You know, you could be like Tony Stark, make your own elements.
It's amazing what you can do if you're a comic book scientist. Anyways, this electron beam deflects, and that deflection is a transfer of momentum from the electric field to the electron. And yeah, if you have a curving electron path, that should have some radiation associated. That's what the issue they had was. Now you have that curvature, and then you send that out to some screen somewhere, and you just look at how far that's deflected, and that gives you your measurement. How far it's deflected is going to be related to how strong that field is.
But the trajectory is going to be altered because of the radiation.
Well, yeah, so the trajectory is going to be altered by the electric field, and then if you have that radiation has momentum as well.
Right, so as it's turning, it's emitting radiation.
Yes.
And that's going to alter the precision of your measurement because it's going to change the curvature.
That's right.
They're saying this is a fundamental limit that you can't escape.
That's what they're saying.
And poor, was it Gamow, I think? They drew an illustration of Gamow tied to a chair with his mouth gagged and Bohr standing over him waving his finger.
Well, yeah, Gamow was the guy who drew stuff like that. He's the guy who did Mr. Tompkins books and things like that. So he did a lot of popular books in the 1960s, I think. And describing relativity and quantum mechanics. And he'd like to do all those illustrations and things like that. I know
somebody else like that. So you're not the first physicist who can draw well as calculate quantum theory.
Well, he could calculate quantum theory and draw. I don't know if I can do either of those. The problem was then, you know, what was going on? How are we limiting this? Why can we actually measure this or not measure it? And what's going on with, and the limitation seemed to be in this energy-time uncertainty relationship, right?
Right.
So if you knew exactly when that radiation was emitted, then you wouldn't have any problem either, because that radiation would be dependent on the trajectory of the electron, and that would mean it would come out at a certain spot and all that other stuff, if you knew exactly when the...
And apparently this took 3 years for Bohr and Rosenfeld to figure out, but they eventually arrived at the solution that you can measure to arbitrary accuracy, things like the electric field and the velocity, right?
Well, yes, they did figure that out. And that all had to do with some problem with the energy and time uncertainty principle. Right, we know how long that electron more or less has to stay in that capacitor because it's the transverse momentum that's being added, not the momentum in the direction of travel. Right? So we know how long it's got to be in there, and therefore, you know, we should be able to measure the amount of deflection. The amount of deflection tells us how much energy was transferred. So that sort of says you know delta E and you know delta T to arbitrary precision.
Right.
You know that. The uncertainty in the energy and the uncertainty in the time, arbitrary precision, which isn't true because there's an energy-time uncertainty relationship. So if you can measure this electric field accurately, then you can measure the energy accurately and you can measure the time accurately at the same time.
Which is classically what we've always thought was impossible, or at least that's been taught, you know, in all the undergraduate and mainstream physics articles I've been reading, and that's 60, 70 years after this.
Yeah, well, there's some caveats to all that, right? I mean, it's not just that you can measure all this way. But yeah, I mean, that's what everybody said, and they've got like four good arguments here.
Right.
Right. They've got four good arguments about why that would be impossible, why you cannot measure delta E and delta T to arbitrary precision simultaneously. The first one had to do with the photon energy, right?
Right.
Which is related to the frequency, which is related to the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you do a Fourier transform, right, and you break everything out, everything down into its sine, cosine components, you end up with the change in the energy being proportional to the uncertainty in the frequency.
Which is related to the time.
Which has to be related to the time that it's going to take for this thing to travel through this capacitor, because this thing has to be limited to this region.
Okay.
For wherever it's going to actually make the transition, wherever there's going to be an energy transfer, has to be within the place where there's actually an electric field to transfer it. I hope that makes sense.
It's eluding me.
So there's a specific region where there's an electric field in between these capacitor plates. If the electron is going to be deflected by that electric field, it has to be in the region between those capacitor plates. Which
we need to know how long it's in that space.
You know how long it's in that space. It also has some implications on the wave function. So the wave function has to be in that space. Right?
So the whole wave function has to be in that space.
At least after the transition, right?
Yeah, that's where it gets a little confusing. Is that you start talking about measurements after an influence in order to figure out variables before the influence.
You know, basically that means you're stuck, right? The change in the frequency has got to be greater than Planck's constant divided by the time. And so delta E times the time has to be greater than or equal to H. And so that's a little bit more stringent than the general energy time uncertainty principle by a factor of something like pi. So that's one way. Another way they went through and they actually figured out what the probability of different energies for the transitions are. And they said, you know, you have a 90% chance of the change in the energy being greater than H over T again. And that was figured out by figuring out what the shape of this probability distribution has to be. Another way to do it was, you know, measuring the kinetic energy of a particle hitting something, right? And if you go through and you say, you know, I'm using a particle to measure this thing, if this electron is getting hit by a photon for the energy transfer, then, you know, you have...
There's an uncertainty in when that collision happened because of the position, right?
That's right. That, again, gives you something close to this. That gives you h^2 instead of h over t instead of h, but you know, we're still close enough. We still have those uncertainties, and that's actually the classical one right there. And then you look at the stuff we did in the last chapter that we were just talking about. If you're measuring the velocity, that's related to the change, the uncertainty in the energy, which is basically just a derivative of the energy. That again has the same sort of size.
Because they all acquire this time interval.
Yeah.
And wherever you get that time interval, you invoke the uncertainty principle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then there's the arguments against those.
And so there were a couple of arguments against that. One of them is that time's not a property of the system. Time's not a property of the electron. You're not really looking at a property of the electron when you're looking at the time, right? You're looking at some property of the world or something like that. It's this other thing. So if that's true, then this whole artifice that we built up in the last chapter doesn't apply, because what we wanted to do was, we wanted to make sure everything had to do with either the detector or the particle. And we found that if we just looked at the particle, then we couldn't measure this velocity, right?
Right.
We got some sort of convolution of stuff from the detector interfering with our measurement. In this case, though, we're looking at the time, and that's a property of the world.
And we can measure that to arbitrary precision.
So, yeah, we should be able to measure that to arbitrary precision. That should commute with the energy, because it's just a time, right? It's just something out there doing its thing. You know, it has nothing to do with our measurement. For that reason, T is a property of the device, right? The time operator has something to do with the device. The energy has to do with the system. There's no commutation relationship. They have to do with different things. One has to do with the world. One has to do with the electron. What was the other one? The other one was looking at the interaction Hamiltonian from the last chapter. In that case, the interaction Hamiltonian had something to do with the measured system, the device probes, something to do with the device probe, times a coupling efficiency.
That's right. I think this is where they resolve the conundrum, is that they say, well, if you just look at the Hamiltonian, the energy structure of the particle itself, then yes, all the former arguments would apply. But if you get the Hamiltonian of what you're measuring, the Hamiltonian of the device, and then the interaction Hamiltonian, and you put them all together into one general Hamiltonian, then you can start mixing these terms up to work to your advantage to eliminate some of this uncertainty by coupling some things together.
And in fact, it turned out that there was something really interesting that happened necessarily because of this interaction.
Yeah, that's the part that I really wanted to ask you about, because that was a little unclear to me, and it's fascinating. So how is that?
How is what?
There's this coupling that happens,
mm-hmm.
and it seems like it's assumed in the way that it's explained that coupling by its nature will help you put a probe into your experiment and I guess excite the probe. So then the probe is coupled to your measurement in a way that helps you get the measurement out with arbitrary precision. How is that relationship? How does the coupling to your electron, for example, take place in such a way that this interaction Hamiltonian gives you an opportunity to measure the velocity of the electron with arbitrary precision? They talk a little bit about oscillations, I think, in the probe, some kind of compensating forces in this section.
Well,
here.
That's what they're talking about, is mm-hmm. that this interaction part of the Hamiltonian necessarily creates a compensating force.
How does that work?
I'm not sure how that works.
It's fascinating. Because you would have thought, well, maybe the probe would introduce some noise through its interaction with the electron that would make it more uncertain as to which part was electron and which part was probe.
That is what happens if you don't understand the Hamiltonian perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
Right, if you know the Hamiltonian of the system, then I think all of the conservation relationships will lead a force on the system, basically, that compensates for the interaction.
Oh, okay, I see. So the interaction Hamiltonian is something that you have to establish between your device and the thing that you're measuring. And then once you understand that Hamiltonian perfectly, you can basically subtract it out.
I think that's part of what's going on. It was a little bit odd there where they just said that.
Yeah, he was just like, and of course it compensates, and, you know, it's like, really? Well, how is it by its nature going to help you in this measurement?
Part of that is part of his analogy. So what he does is he's decided to, you know, create this sort of compensating force classically. So he's made a model for the compensating force classically using a Lagrangian instead of a Hamiltonian. That's another way of building up the laws of motion. You can use a Hamiltonian system, you could use a Lagrangian system, you could use Newton's laws. Because of the way quantum mechanics is set up, we use Hamiltonians all the time. Lagrangians are useful because they're very easy to put constraints in, for example.
They're kind of intuitive to think of, because you look at those equations and you understand them classically.
I'm not sure if you look at Euler's equations and they make sense immediately, but they definitely do end up making an easier batch of differential equations to figure out what to do with. So with those, you're looking at the difference between the kinetic and the potential energy. That's supposed to be some constant or something. So you take some derivatives, and all of a sudden you have these Euler equations, and you can make all sorts of predictions about stuff. In this case, what they've done is they've decided to throw in that interaction term and figure out what's going on. And they say, okay, if you want a ball bouncing against a table, right, and you want to make the table have a truly elastic collision, you have to add energy into the table because it's a lossy table. You're always going to lose something to the table. You're always going to lose something to deformation and heat in the ball and all those other things. So what you have to do is you have to basically hit the table at the same time the ball hits the table, and you can compensate for the energy loss.
Okay.
Right.
Now I understand it better. So you're actually very precisely introduced this interaction quality.
Yeah.
So that it cancels this energy loss in that example. Okay. So you just tune your apparatus, and now all of a sudden you're in a different ballpark because the apparatus is coupled to what you're measuring. You've compensated for these uncertainties, for these losses, and now you can get some real numbers out of this thing.
And that's when we get to this point where he starts talking about how to do quantum measurements of non-canonical observables. You know, we should look at what quantum measurements were. What sort of things do you need to have a quantum measurement of a canonical observable? We ought to remember what those are before we start talking about what happens with the non-canonical ones.
I believe, well, we talked about a couple of them before.
Yes. So von Neumann had, I think, four things that we needed to have.
Five things. It's been a few weeks since we did our last episode.
So number five, or the five things were, you have to have a limited time for the interaction. There has to be a change that corresponds to the value of the observable. Limited time in our case here is the interaction has to happen in between the capacitor plates.
Right. Right.
The electron has some sort of longitudinal speed, and the capacitor plates have a definite size, so that limits it to a time.
Mm-hmm.
The second one was the change. Like we said, you know, there's some...
Before and after they measure.
Yeah, right. So afterwards we've added some momentum, and that means that your beam will be deflected when you put it on something where you can actually measure its position. The measurement can't change the observable, and that's where you need the canonical observable. So if you measure just the velocity instead of the momentum, then you'll actually change the value of the velocity.
Right, because you can't measure the velocity without it interacting, and therefore the exchange of energy, right?
Yeah. Okay. But if you measure the momentum, you shouldn't change the value of the momentum. The interaction time could be very small. You shouldn't have to wait for a very, very long time to make that measurement. The interaction time, in most cases, you'd say is itself instantaneous, right?
Sure, you've got a photon colliding with an electron. How long are they interacting? Boy, must be small.
Yeah, so that's more or less instantaneous. We might not know exactly when that happens, but when it does happen, it's a definite event.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, the measurement is itself a quantum process. Right. So, you know, we have to worry about both the quantum mechanical nature of the electron and the quantum mechanical nature of the electric field. It has its quantum mechanical nature as well, and that's where we ended up having to use the interaction Hamiltonian. And then we go on here to these non-canonical observables. I guess, again, we have to have this interaction term where we have some system observable coupled to our measurement, for example, the momentum measurement. The value of the observable has to be the same. This non-canonical observable has to be the same before and after the measurement.
Okay.
So that also has to happen.
So the experiment has to be set up in such a way that that's the kind of experiment you're
running.
Yeah. Okay.
So it can change while the measurement's going on.
So you got your velocity or your electron coming in at a certain speed. It can turn, which is, you know, going to change its velocity in any given vector during the turn. But when it's done turning, it's going to keep moving at the same velocity that it started with.
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
So it could do anything it wanted to do as long as when it came out, it had the same value of the observable.
Okay.
Three, the measurement yields a value for the non-canonical observable before and after the measurement.
But not during the measurement.
But not during the measurement.
That's odd. It's like, well, you can't look at what's going on behind the curtain while it's going on. But when it's all over, you'll have what you're looking for.
And so basically this is going to mean that there has to be that compensating force.
Right.
And that compensating force, I mean, it's just like the table, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're saying the table, when we're hitting it with a ball, we're going to pretend that the table stays flat. We know it doesn't stay flat, because it's a real thing, and the ball's pushing on the atoms, and it bends it a little bit, right?
Mm.
You know, we can't really say what's going on with that interaction when it's there, because we have to push the thing up. But after we're done pushing it up and basically keeping it straight, or...
Well, imagine, I was just thinking about, imagine that you've got, you know, an impact happening on the surface of your table, and you've got a metal table. You could have an inductor underneath to exert exactly the right amount of force to correct so that the table doesn't bend.
Yeah.
And he's talking about setting up an experiment kind of like that so that it compensates for that.
Yeah, he's saying that quantum mechanically that's going to happen no matter what. And so that compensating force can be hidden somewhere in the Hamiltonian, and if you can do that, you can have this impulsive measurement. Right? And impulsive means it can be as short as you want.
Okay.
Which is kind of a little bit weird because we have to have this force, right?
Force and time are related, right? Initially, he said that he was talking about instantaneously, but what we're really talking about is just an arbitrarily short time.
Arbitrarily short means it breaks that energy-time uncertainty
right.
relationship.
Right. And if I understood this correctly, and I'm not sure that I did, but it seems like this is accomplished because the uncertainties associated with the device are going to be, some of those uncertainties are going to be much, much less than the uncertainties associated with something like a single particle. And it's almost like by coupling them, you're borrowing additional certainty from the device. Is that right?
The wave
function of your experimental apparatus is obviously going to be, it's going to be very, very small. But for an electron, it's much, much larger. But if they're coupled, it almost seems like using this procedure that you can look at it globally so that you're getting a higher level of precision. You're getting in that little interval the kind of uncertainty that would be associated with the device, which is negligible, right?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if there's any upper limit to the precision associated with that.
He does talk about the coupling to the electric field momentum. I can't see anywhere where he said that there's a limit.
Right. No, I didn't run across one, but I was intrigued by it because I was thinking, well, there's always some kind of uncertainty limit, isn't there?
Well, there's always going to be an experimental limit, right?
That right, doesn't theoretically
mean it is different from saying something like the uncertainty principle, right?
Right.
Which is a fundamental limit. Yeah, and apparently, these things come out of this quantum analysis, and to prove it, Aharonov and Rohrlich go through this process of measuring the electric field by shooting an electron through a capacitor, mathematically going step by step by step, pulling out a spring constant for a restoring force
right.
that should do the same thing as your inductor. That's a reasonably complicated procedure. First, you have to measure EX in the Coulomb gauge, or you have to measure the electric field in one direction with the Coulomb gauge using the charged heavy sphere.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I remember that model now.
Then you take the field momentum to be proportional to the electric field, which it is. That's just the way things are. Look at some Fourier components of both the momenta and say, okay, well, what does the detector see? And you get something that looks like a detector momentum times the electric field. Then you find a compensating force. And they have a nice, incredibly complicated equation for the compensating force. But
yeah.
Apparently, this compensating force, which has lots of terms and trig functions and things like that in it, that completely eliminates the uncertainty.
Huh. Right. Yeah, when he started giving this example and he talked about the heavy sphere, that's where I started thinking, well, does it have to be heavy because part of this detection apparatus needs to have a really small de Broglie wavelength in order to compensate for these uncertainties? But at the end, it seems like it's in the nature of the mathematics, isn't it? So if you replace that really heavy sphere with a much smaller one, could you get the same result?
So I'd expect that you couldn't, because there'd be a net transfer of momentum to that sphere. You'd have this really large sphere, and you need to have the situation where you don't have many components of your Fourier analysis at high frequencies. Basically, it has to be focused on low frequencies. So you can't have anything high frequency going on, and if you have a small mass, probably you're going to have some high frequency interaction terms.
I see. So it's like a dampener using that big mass.
The measurement is going to measure the average electric field as if there was no measurement. Right? That compensating force will help you pretend there was no measurement.
Interesting. It's a little sleight of hand, huh?
And then we get here. We get to, what does this energy time uncertainty principle mean anyway?
What the hell does it mean?
Well, I mean, we were just saying that, the traditional idea is that the faster the measurement, the less certain your result of the energy is, right?
Mm-hmm. Ah, yes, the internal time and the external time.
Yeah, you get into some differences between what's happening internally as far as time is concerned and what's happening externally.
Yeah, I thought I'd heard it all, but I had never heard time broken down in that way.
Probably the system, as long as they don't interact, the systems are allowed to evolve however they want to. I mean, how can they keep track of time if they're not interacting with anything?
It's an interesting fundamental question.
How can the electron know how long it's been traveling in some direction?
Unless it interacts with something else outside of itself, yeah.
Yeah.
Somehow this relates to the clock-in-the-box paradox. kind of rolls right off your tongue, doesn't it? The clock in the box paradox.
Well, it does. It sounds like a cat in the hat paradox. But
that one doesn't rhyme.
The cat in the hat?
Well, the hat doesn't rhyme with paradox.
Oh,
in this
there,
case.
There you go. It's the cat in the hat parabat doesn't work. Yeah. So anyways, yeah, so we've got this sort of internal time for the system. And that has to be there because there does have to be some sort of energy time uncertainty relationship. And that ends up being this very strange thing. So it has to do with the ratio of your observable to the time derivative of that observable.
Run that by me again.
The internal time,
right,
is the ratio of your observable to the time derivative. So how quickly does the thing change? So that's what's going on inside. It's actually the operator, I should be saying, not the observable.
That's evolving over time.
That's evolving with time, right? It's that evolution that determines the internal time. Delta T doesn't make sense outside of that internal thing, because the actual time, right, the thing that actually happens, I mean, that's a quantum jump, right? That's instantaneous. There's no period between two things where the value can be one or the other or something in between. You can have a system in an excited state, and then it goes down to the ground state.
Right.
And that happens instantaneously. That happens right now. Now, you might not know when the now is, but it happens at a particular time.
That is a baffling thing. I've often wondered, is there any way that you could measure that? I mean, like the jump of an electron from one energy level to the other.
Yeah, but I mean, the weird thing about...
Does anything in the universe happen instantaneously?
You know, if you're talking about an energy level, right, then it's the wave function that's changing instantaneously. It's not the position, it's not the momentum. It's the wave function changing that changes the energy.
But it's got a position and a momentum.
So it has a position and it has momentum, but both of those positions, both the position and the momentum, are uncertain things. You can only measure them to a certain degree, each one. After that switch, you can still have the same position and the same momentum for a little while until it and it can evolve just freely into a happy state. And sometimes it can fluctuate up, sometimes it can fluctuate down, because it's all random anyway.
Okay. Sorry, I'm just, the idea of, it's just frustrating because you can't visualize a wave function. And your brain wants to.
Well, yeah, I mean, they do it. They draw the little circles, but the circles have nothing to do with, well, the circles are like a 75 or 90% confidence interval or something like that, right? They tell you what the probabilities are for something. Mm-hmm. They don't really tell you what's going on. Nothing's really happened. It could be sitting in one spot this whole time.
Right.
But we don't know.
Yes, yeah, it's a conceptual kind of shell game.
Yeah. Well, you don't want to play quantum shell game.
That'll be the next big thing on the street in 100 years. Hey, it's under none of them. It's behind my ear.
One of the interesting things that I noticed with this is that one of the problems has to do with using these Fourier modes to quantify the Casimir wave.
Wait, where was that? Was that in this
problem 8.1? Oh.
Oh, crap. The problems. Yeah. I thought we agreed not to do these. All right, well, I love the Casimir effect. So what does it say about the Casimir effect?
Oh, well, I mean, it's just using the Fourier modes to show that you have this attraction. So, I mean, it's not something that I think is essential to the chapter.
But it's a nice application, isn't it?
It is a very interesting thing to put in here. So it's got raising and lowering operators, and it's got expressions for the vector potential and the momentum of the field and things like that. They all come together in something that has to do with the Casimir effect.
With the what effect? The Kaon effect? The Casimir, okay. Because the next question was about neutral Kaons. All right, so is there any verdict on that, or is this another one of these things where it's a mathematical argument and you can't prove it one way or the other?
What?
Everybody loves the Casimir effect. It's fascinating. You get two conductive metal plates, uncharged, near each other, they pull together.
Mm-hmm.
And this is explained traditionally as, okay, you're suppressing the vacuum fluctuations between the two plates. You're restricting them to frequencies that are just integer wavelengths. But then I came across this paper recently, and I've seen other people mention it, that you can explain the Casimir effect just as quantum fluctuations, I guess, in the energy levels of the two plates themselves. You can explain the attraction between them without invoking any vacuum energy at all.
Yeah, I think this is sort of what's going on here. There isn't anything in this Fourier analysis that has anything to do with vacuum fluctuation. It just has to do with setting up the problem correctly.
So using this, so in that problem, they're able to derive the magnitude of the Casimir effect without postulating any kind of energy between them and around them?
It looks like it, although there are divergent terms. So the Casimir effect is one of the terms in this explanation.
Oh, I see. Because in this problem, they're actually talking about measuring the strength of the electric field, and the Casimir force is just one of the things in there. So they're not actually deriving the Casimir force in this little example. It's interesting, though. You know, I was reading that you can change the Casimir effect to be positive or negative depending on the geometries, and there's this whole fascinating field of, you know, nanotechnology, where they're looking at modifying surfaces so they can get rid of stick by making just the right amount of, you know, canceling out that interaction. Fascinating stuff.
Okay, so now do you understand it all?
No, but I think I can hobble forward to the next chapter now. Right. Thank you for clarifying so much of that.
That's sufficient for now. I can wander off, call my wife, and all those other fun things.
Looking at the math in these problems, I'm really glad that I didn't try to do any of that stuff. Yeah. That's some advanced mathematics right there.
Yeah, but if you started in chapter one, it would look like nothing.
Oh, boy. Well, I'll have to read this book all over again and do the problems and see how far I get.
Yeah, I keep saying that every time I read it.
Wow, next week we get to do quantum cats.
We eventually get there.
Nice.
Whenever it is that whenever next week is.
Right, next week is probably going to be next month.
There's some quantum uncertainty in when next week is.
All right, Jim. Thanks for your time.
Goodbye now.